Today is Wednesday. It's December 14th, 2022, and it's 2:39 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Portions of this will be broadcast Saturday nights on WGN Radio at 8 o'clock. And you can always hear me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
Hey, it's John Hansen from WGN Radio, Block Club Chicago, and WCIU.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute. You can listen to my podcast, America's Talking.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the still cheerful publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter on Substack.
Maybe 2 weeks in a row Eric's been cheerful, and I don't remember what he was happy about last week.
I was probably cheerful about the Songs of Good Cheer program that was coming up, and now I'm still cheerful because, even though the program is over. And I wanted to thank you again for hosting on Sunday, John. That was really nice of you to come. Bring your wife and sing so nicely on stage with us.
Eric beautiful. Pulls me up onto the stage and says, you know, at certain points, I didn't know they were going to do this. And now John Williams will join us on stage to join us in the sing-along. I thought, I'm standing next to a microphone. I worked off mic the whole time. When I got back to my seat, I said, Brenda, you didn't hear me on the mic. She goes, no, there was, and I think they cut the mic when I get up there. But I cannot sing. You know, even Christmas carols. What's hard about, you know, Christmas carols? Silent night. But thank you.
Even when everyone around you is on the same note, you can't find that pitch with them?
I know what you mean. Doesn't come out of my mouth. And Eric is a good singer and plays the fiddle. What else do you play, Eric? What instruments do you play?
Well, I only play the fiddle at the show. I play banjo and mandolin and guitar also, but not at the show.
Wow.
That is such a nice thing to have.
I'm such a hillbilly.
Everybody, you really are. Everybody should learn to play the piano culture.
I took lessons for 15 years, and I hated the first seven, and I'm so glad my parents made me do it.
And so you could sit down and do a pretty nice number for us or two?
Yeah, right before the Blackhawks game the other night, we were taping something at Queenie's, that bar that's in the United Center. They have a big piano, and I decided to hop on and entertain everyone to some of the Christmas songs I remember.
No kidding.
That's the best part about piano, because if you're the person who takes out a guitar at a gathering, everyone's like, oh God, I want to die. But piano, it's like, hey, it's we play piano. It's fine. You know?
Hey, wait till so you pull true. Out a banjo at a party. Then you'll know the oh God reference.
That is so funny, though, Austin. Right. If you pull out the guitar, it's like, hey, look at me. But if you look at a piano, it's like, hey, look at you. We're all going to gather around, and you don't have to be that good.
It's like in Animal House, where the guy's singing, I gave my love a cherry.
Do you know who that was sitting on the steps before John Belushi destroys the guitar? That was Stephen Bishop, On and On and stuff like that, pop singer. Estimated probability of accuracy of that, 80%. Very high for me. Very high. I'm almost certain that is, in fact, Stephen Bishop. I'm getting a nod from producer Pete. He's confirming it, so we don't even need to look it up now.
I gave my love a story that had no end. I give...
Sorry.
Okay, so let's take a look at the mayoral race in Chicago. There's a poll out that says that Garcia over Lightfoot by a lot, right? But who did that poll, Eric? What's the story on that?
Well, the poll was taken by a union that is backing Garcia, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's inaccurate.
But Chuy Garcia, obviously. Yeah.
Chuy Garcia, the congressman, yeah. And it doesn't necessarily mean the poll is inaccurate. And in fact, I don't really doubt that Garcia is ahead of Lightfoot in some polls at this point. But when you have these internal polls that come out, when it's not done by an independent organization, you always have to take it with a grain of salt, because you never know exactly how the question was asked.
Didn't Darren Bailey have some polling that said he was doing very well prior to the election? How'd that work out, Ryan?
I think it was. He was down 9 points after they asked a pretty inflammatory question as their initial opening. But you're right. But you know, I will say that, you know, internal polling can be accurate, but it's always the polls of polls that you like to see. And internal polls, if it's negative, they don't release it, right? That's what an internal poll is. It's your campaign's PR wing. If it's a good poll that they like, they'll release it. If it's not, they don't. So you often wonder, what I always wonder when I see that there's campaigns that aren't releasing polls, I wonder, Well, what's their internal polls telling them?
What do they
them?
Know that they're not telling us?
I would not be surprised if Garcia were doing pretty well right now in early polling. People are clearly unhappy with Lightfoot, and they're looking for an alternative. And Garcia has a lot of name recognition, and he is favored certainly by progressive Democrats in the city who went for Lightfoot in a big way 4 years ago. So the idea that Garcia is leading, that he is going to be maybe the candidate to beat, is not far-fetched
no,
as far as I'm
no.
concerned.
No. Here's Fran Spielman's writing in the Sun Times. Representative Chuy Garcia appears to be running away with the race for mayor of Chicago, according to a poll bankrolled, as you said, by a powerful construction union. Before operating engineers, Local 150 made a $1 million commitment to the campaign. The poll of 700 likely Chicago voters conducted November 10th to the 17th by Impact Research shows Garcia leading Lightfoot by 7 percentage points in round one. And then if it's to the two of them, he beats her by 31 percentage points. Austin, does that sound plausible to you?
Yeah, the head-to-heads sound very plausible to me. It's a big problem for the incumbent. You want to be going into a race with at least some kind of cushion. And that's why you see Lori Lightfoot on TV with ads every day and a new one seemingly every week, is to get her favorables up. The other part about that poll, which is very interesting to me, is the total ubiquitous dominance of public safety and crime as the number one issue for Chicagoans. I think if you took public safety and crime, it was something like 70%+ of people were rating either one of those as their number one issue. And so you'd have to think that whoever, whatever candidate is coming across as most credible and trustworthy on that issue has a very, very good shot. And you saw in the last couple of days, Paul Vallis put out a very comprehensive plan on public safety. That's something I've not really seen from any of the other candidates. But I mean, if anything, Paul Vallis is a policy wonk, and he will put together some plans that are not pie in the sky stuff, but most of it is pretty feasible. It included things like removing the residency requirement for officers in good standing who have been there on the force for 15 years, which I think is a very interesting idea. The hit against removing residency requirements for teachers or police officers is obviously, well, you want people working or tied to the communities that they are serving. But I think what's odd about that line of reasoning is that you don't have police officers living on the west and south sides anyway. And in fact, you would want a police officer to be able to live in Oak Park and serve the Austin neighborhood. That's actually much closer to the community that they serve rather than living up on the Northwest side somewhere or down in Beverly. Yeah. So I thought that was a really one of a few pretty solid ideas from Vallis on public safety.
Well, and of course, there are a lot of suburban communities, probably nearly all of them, where the police officers don't live in the community that they serve in, and that doesn't seem to impact their ability to do their jobs. I think it has more to do with the tax base, that they don't want people leaving the city, and you have these decently paid city employees. You want them living in houses and paying property taxes in your city, I think. Otherwise, I don't see the rationale. Austin, when you did your book comparing Chicago to all these other cities, do all major cities have those kind of residency requirements?
It's a mixed bag, and I don't know what it is for police officers off the top of my head, but I really think so. Yeah, one element is the tax base, but you've got to think, if there's a problem with recruiting good talent to serve as police officers, which I think there's a peak of 13,000 officers under Emanuel right now, or around 11,000, a little over 11,000 officers. So this is a problem that needs to be addressed. I think part of the reason, this is certainly the case for Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Teachers Union, is that the union that is bargaining these contracts has a vested interest in as many members living in the city as possible, because that means political power.
Yep.
And that, I think, is the reason that it's really persisted more than anything in Chicago. I
mean, haven't the unions asked for the residency requirement to be lifted, though?
I think there's part of that is when it comes down to you're in the room together and you're behind closed doors, you might publicly telegraph, yeah, you know, we hear you guys. You don't have to live in Chicago. But at the end of the day, it's like it's in both the city's interest and the union leadership's interest to keep that in place.
Going back to the mayor's race for just one second, I was curious what you guys thought about the idea that pick any candidate besides Lori Lightfoot, and if you told them that they were going to go to the runoff, whether they would prefer to have Lori Lightfoot as their opponent or somebody else. And for a lot of the situations, I think they would rather run against Lori Lightfoot. Am I crazy in that? Or does she still have more support than I realize? I'm just wondering, would Chuy Garcia feel better going against Lori Lightfoot, the incumbent, or another candidate?
That's a great question. I think everyone wants to run against Lightfoot. And you see even, you know, Willie Wilson, I think, when they polled, and he's known. So that's it's a different thing when it's like, well, Brandon Johnson versus Lori Lightfoot. Well, nobody really knows. Very few people know who Brandon Johnson is, for example, the CTU political director. For someone like a Willie Wilson, I think it was like 44 Lightfoot, 42 Wilson or something like that. That's a huge problem for the mayor, because people know who Willie Wilson is. And the fact that so many people are picking him,
that's a huge problem
compared
for the
to
city.
Lightfoot is a problem.
I just want to say, I want to get back to this idea that if Vallis can credibly identify himself as the one who is serious about crime control and has a plan that he wants to implement, I mean, I think that he is a wonky guy. I know he's a little bit too conservative, probably for Chicago voters in general. That's certainly going to be the rap against him. That he's too in bed with the police union and so on. But that issue being as salient as it is, and Vallis being the one who's speaking perhaps the most credibly on it. I mean, Willie Wilson says some of the same things, but he doesn't seem to have the same sort of chops when it comes to policy that Vallis has. So I think that could really play to Vallis's advantage. And you might end up seeing Vallis against Garcia, that unless Lightfoot can really pull up her negatives or push down her negatives, pull up her positives with the advertising coming up. So I'm not as sure as I was that Lightfoot's going to be in the final two.
Chuy Garcia said if he were elected, he would immediately fire Superintendent David Brown, that crime is the issue and Brown is doing a terrible job. And he would take the handcuffs, or was that a Willie Wilson line? It could have been any of them. I would take the handcuffs off of the police officers and put them on the criminals.
That was Wilson.
Was that Willie Wilson?
And every Republican gubernatorial candidate in Illinois.
Well,
also
it does make
that.
Me wonder why crime is so resonant in the mayoral race, but it really wasn't the issue. It didn't define – it defined Darren Bailey's campaign, but it didn't work.
Or the country, right? I was going to say the same thing. But I think it's because Chicagoans living in Chicago neighborhoods see this – pretty firsthand. We've all talked about how it is a little different, perhaps, riding the CTA than we felt before. And I think suburban voters, obviously, as part of a state election, may tout crime as an important issue. But when they get in the ballot box, they haven't experienced that maybe firsthand. I think it does make a difference in the city race, but maybe not as much as they're polling right now. Right. It's always something people complain about. Not always, but it is really something people complain about in pre-election polling, but in exit polls, and again, maybe not the most reliable things, but it's not always the number one or two issue. In fact, often it's not.
But what are they going to do? Like, if you're the mayor, what are you going to do to crack down on crime? And your crackdown needs to work. It needs to be fair, it needs to be legal, and it needs to work. I just, you know, when they always say, I'm going to crack down on crime, we're going to put the criminals in jail. I thought, oh, I've heard that 1,000 times. I think Lori Lightfoot said something like that. It must be more difficult.
And I think detail really helps. And you're going to have both on, say, someone really wants to take a tough on crime stance. They're like, well, we got to take these, you know, handcuffs off the criminals finally, right? It's like, okay, what does that mean? And then on the other side, you'll have a Brandon Johnson or someone in progressive left saying, well, we need to invest in communities. Like, how many times have we heard, well, we got to invest in communities and that's the only way to solve crime? That's also not specific. It's not tied to any kind of dollar amount. It's not tied to a plan. Vallis, whether you agree with them or disagree with them, this is a comprehensive plan about more effective management of the Chicago Police Department. One thing that I think it's lacking is a focus on the consent decree, which I think is the number one thing you can focus on to improve management of police. But there's a lot of great stuff. So one of them was, we want a CTA police transit unit run by the equivalent of a district commander and staffed by 700 officers. CTA is paying $100 million a year on private security. You use that $100 million to go pay for a unit of the police.
CTA is paying $100 million a year on private security?
That's what Vallis is claiming. It's wasting $100 million a year on private security.
If that's true, that's amazing to me.
There's other items like revamping. So the Inspector General's office had a really interesting report on the Chicago Police Department in the background check process, disqualifying too many qualified applicants to become police officers because of essentially the neighborhoods they were raised in, right? So they'll have an association with someone who might be, you know, in a gang. So like he's addressing the labor problem. There's some stuff on the actual policing, like 10% needs to be of the labor force needs to be detectives, for example. These are all specific things that can be debated. But when you're in this like talking point thing, I hope voters will actually vote on who they trust to actually execute some kind of a plan on public safety.
He's got a lot of specific items in his agenda, things like he wants to approve a strong public nuisance ordinance that uses really big fines and vehicle impoundment to punish looters, flash mobs, and others for crimes that he says that the state's attorney isn't going to prosecute. And these sorts of specific things, as Austin points out, they're all debatable. I think they're going to resonate with voters who are tired of seeing stories about these like these armed robbery crews that are cruising through Wicker Park and near Northside neighborhoods and getting 8-10 victims a night and so on. I think people hear about that and it frightens them and they want to know what's being done about it. And if you have somebody who says, "Look, I have a plan," even if that plan doesn't hold up to exact scrutiny, it still sounds like he wants to do something, and it's not clear to me what any of the other candidates or what Mayor Lightfoot, for one, is doing about that to make people feel better about the future, make people feel like, well, crime is coming down. She's got this under control. So I think it could actually be a very serious issue. Now, of course, February, crime's going to be down. It's going to be cold, and so it may not be top of mind at that point. But I wouldn't discount that issue at all.
Can I just make the point for the 1,000th time on this podcast that we need ranked choice voting in Chicago and in Illinois and across the whole country? Again, sorry.
How does that work this time, John? How would you think that would – who would win if we did it right now with that?
Ooh, a follow-up. That's a good one. Chuy Garcia.
It's what I do for a living, John.
It's who you – in ranked choice voting, you ultimately look at favorability rating, and the one with the highest favorability rating usually wins because – as you move down the line, you might have a preferred candidate over that person because they align perfectly with your values. But your people that are favorable, likable, more moderate end up being boosted. I think Avalis could do very well in ranked choice voting. So just the idea of two people, 15% moving on to a runoff is insanity.
Well, I kind of like the idea, you know, they call ranked choice voting instant runoff voting, but yeah. I kind of like the idea of when you have a field of what we're going to have probably maybe 7-8 candidates to have ranked choice voting. And then after that, after you've picked the top two, then have those two go at it head to head, because I think it's very useful not to have to do your runoff right away when you have something like a mayor's race. So you could pick the top two and then have another couple of months to pit those two candidates against each other and really compare their programs.
I'm trying to simplify this, Eric.
You want more elections, Eric? Yes.
No. We already have.
I know that, but I mean, to me, ranked choice voting does everything you want it to do in one fell swoop.
Every vote ends up counting. Yeah. I mean, at the end of unless you've left part of your ballot blank, as long as you rank all of them,
yeah,
you will have some voice at the end to determine who wins.
Austin, you like Vallis. You think he is sounds like you would recommend somebody vote for him? You think he could win?
I think that, to me, in terms of the problems facing the city and having experience in management and some kind of a plan, Vallis is clearly the best of the bunch on that metric. Now, that's not the metric on which everybody votes. But so in New York City, there's a ranked choice voting system. And that is credited in some ways for helping Eric Adams become mayor of New York City, even though, you know, New York City is a left-leaning city. And on crime, he very much did have sort of a, let's say, if the spectrum is soft versus tough on crime, that was certainly, you know, he was more tough on crime messaging and had support of the police. So, yeah, I do think Avalis could win under ranked choice voting. But, yeah, in terms of the plans that have come out so far from candidates, Avalis is by far the best on that measure for me. And that could change as people put out other things. But he's been very strong on that.
Was Vallis, who you said mentioned that we need to spend money better on the safety on the CTA, you pointed out to me a WirePoints.com article about how efficient or inefficient the CTA is, how safe it is or isn't. And one of the things that they concluded in this story, Matt Rosenberg and Ted Dabrowski, you interned for one of them, right?
I interned for Ted when I was 19 years old. Yeah. I've known Ted for a long time.
He said that you should make the service match the revenues. I wonder if that's going to hurt, you know, the people that actually need it the most, right? In poor neighborhoods where maybe they don't generate a lot of revenue for the CTA, but where those people don't have as many options as well. I don't know. What was your overview of what they put forward to make the CTA better?
The big overview for me is you had – there's a lot of people who will dismiss the idea that, oh, you need to operate government like a business. On some areas, you have to operate some of government like a business. And I think transit is actually one of those areas. And the thing with transit is ridership plummeted, but spending kept going up for
during
the CTA.
During the pandemic, you're talking.
During the pandemic. Yeah, exactly. So, and it's still down. Ridership's still down 38% on the CTA, and their operating costs are still really, really high. So the problem there is, yeah, maybe there's equity concerns, right, about they're talking about raising fares, for example, to make this up, rather than reducing services. That's not fair. You shouldn't be raising fares on poor Chicagoans when you have done nothing to control your costs after, you know, your primary, one of your primary sources of revenue, fares, plummeted. 43% of the revenue was fares in 2019. In 2021, it was 18%. So this revenue went down a lot, but they're just not doing anything to control
it. But it's not fair for people if the people who most need a bus or train can't get a bus or train because there's fewer buses or trains in their neighborhood too, right?
Yeah. And isn't it, if you are running things like a business, sometimes you invest more into areas where you think you maybe overspend in areas to try and entice people back to the product that you ultimately want them to use?
But ultimately, if you can't at least what they're running into now, because they did not control the expense side, is that now that federal funding is drying up, they're talking about service cuts and fare hikes. And that's, you know, nobody likes that either. Right. So the point is, you had, during a time where there was very low ridership, you could have identified areas where, OK, you know, this community is still using transit a lot. We can keep the ridership high there. But, you know, I would think of something like the Brown Line running north, servicing a lot of work from home, higher income professionals, and they're not taking the CTA, and they're still running the CTA at the same rate. And now they're talking about, okay, oh man, we're in this big financial hole. We got to raise fares on everybody. That's not equitable.
Why didn't they lay off more people on the CTA or do something to cut the cost during the pandemic? I remember they were kind of proud of the fact that nobody's losing their jobs. And
this is the pandemic, John. Wait, you want the city to lay off a bunch of their workers in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, workers who aren't working, yeah. I mean, are you being sarcastic or are you being sincere?
I mean, in the middle.
You don't get to be.
But I mean, really, John, and people talk about
this. The state of Illinois was this. The Secretary of State's office was this way, too. And the offices were closed. And they didn't fire all those people or furlough them.
This is like the argument about how we shouldn't have done PPP loans because it turns out there were some fraudulent people that took the wrong money. Or we overshot by putting too much money into the economy.
We did.
It's really easy now to look back and say that. But March, April, May, when we have no idea what's happening, it's imperative that we keep people working during that time, keep people employed, keep money flowing to save lives and save the economy. And then you fix that later. I know that's a very easy thing to say, but I mean, you're going to March 13th, you shut down the city and you say, now we're going to lay off half the CTA workers who are living paycheck to paycheck already.
It was so long and the service was either so cut, was so not being used, or in the case of the state, you couldn't access services. It did seem to me to be weird to keep those people on full payroll. I hear what you're saying about the plight of those people. I didn't have to take a pay cut. Lucky me. But
I know a lot of businesses would be screaming at me on my show right now saying if you had laid them off, they would enter a labor market where we needed workers in other jobs.
So well, thank you for that.
Perhaps that's the market working itself out. Perhaps there's a fair point. That's why I said I was in the middle between the two.
And of course, one thing you don't want to do is end up putting transit systems into a spiral. And so if you cut costs now, if you do that by cutting routes or cutting employees, making it less safe to ride the buses and trains, you end up driving customers away that in some ways the system needs to continue. I think I agree with John that it needs to continue to invest in itself. I think this idea of extending the red line south from 95th Street to where they 135th, is that where it's going?
Yeah.
130. That's going to cost a lot of money. And yet it's something I think that we need to do, the city needs to do in order to increase the idea of transit equity around the city. And as jerry-rigged as the process is of taking tax money from one part of the city and throwing it into another, I think that's something that we have to do, that a good city, a great city, needs a great transit system. And that's going to be true going forward.
Do you see Blair Kamen's new book, which is a compilation of 50-plus of his previous columns, plus Lee Bay, the Sun-Times architect, critic's photographs, and then he updated all of them. He said the most important architectural or civic engineering thing that has happened in this city in Pickett is the Red Line extension. And he used that phrase equity, Eric, not to mean necessarily fairness to blacks and whites or poor and rich, but the city has a sort of value. You know, there's a certain equity in Chicago, and some of our architecture adds to the equity and some of it doesn't. So he said the Jeanne Gang building adds to the city's equity, not just because it's a pretty building, but it accesses nicely the Riverwalk. People can sort of access it that way. So it adds almost financial value, but people can access it equitably and it's open to the community that way. Anyway, he said that the Red Line is an equity project. We need to do that to sort of maintain the value of Chicago's holdings, you know, the downtown, the neighborhoods. It's a good book, by the way. And he thought of equity in two ways, and equity applies to both in the case of the extension of the Red Line down there.
The infrastructure has economic value, no doubt about it. Like, we need to have great infrastructure as a city if we're going to grow economically, but there also has to be a balance between, well, what are what does an actually smart investment look like? And I'm not saying this isn't a smart investment, but when you have you know, if the operating concern is let's keep as many CTA employees employed as possible,
that's a
problem, because then the logic becomes, let's just run trains to nowhere all day and keep all these people employed. Meanwhile, you got people, you know, trying to get to their job downtown from the south or west sides, and they're paying higher fares to fund this thing.
Where were you when John Hansen was beating me up? That's, I was trying to say something like that. And that, I mean, I guess at some point, John, that was kind of where I got off, no pun intended. But it's like at some point we have to decide that we don't need this many employees, or that or that they're not offering any value right now. It's not charity.
I guess I was alluding to maybe the first couple months, but you're right. This lagged on and has lagged on now for 2 years or so. And the problems are terrible. Now that people are trying to ride it more, it's absurd how little service there is and how wide gaps there are between trains. If the costs keep going up, why are there so many ghost trains and ghost buses? I mean,
Where are those? Because producer Pete rides the train, the Red Line, from north to downtown, and he said it's crowded a lot. Austin, you ride the train a lot. Is it pretty crowded for you?
I don't see ghost trains too much, and I don't ride the bus that much, so I can't speak to ghost buses. But ghost buses, I think a lot of people have cited that as a big concern, is you can't get reliable bus service. Train service, I've not noticed personally a difference in.
There was a Reddit thread for a while in the last week or so just about the conditions on the train still, you know, people smoking and just behaving in either ways that break the rules or make the train feel not safe. That surely was a hallmark of the first couple of years of the pandemic. They were empty or they were populated by a few people who were sleeping, smoking, or you thought maybe getting ready to do something you didn't want to be part of.
Well, as it gets more crowded, it feels safer.
Yeah, that's for sure. Speaking of the pandemic a little bit, J.B. Pritzker, Austin, you pointed out to us, is now 1,000 days into his emergency order. That's the emergency order from March of 2020? Yes,
yeah,
right?
It's been re-upped monthly.
And so what's the – because you don't have to wear a mask anymore. How does he justify – still having emergency say over the state?
There's a few different explanations that have been used, but the most common one recently is the fact that the federal government is giving us more support on food stamps and on Medicaid, so that it's his responsibility as governor to continue this, so that federal money doesn't stop flowing. And we are one of only seven states that is still under some kind of emergency declaration. So
he's playing the problem with that government there.
Exactly. And the problem with that is actually very similar to what we just talked about with the CTA, which is, hey, federal money's flowing. What do we need to stop? You know, like, keep it coming, boys. Like, great. We don't have to change anything. But now we have Illinois has a record high share of its population receiving food assistance in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's 15.5% of Illinoisans are currently using that. And we also have a record high share of folks dependent on Medicaid in Illinois. It's 28% as of this year. So we've created a lot of dependency with this federal money, but that federal money won't be there forever. It will eventually run out. So I think it's a dangerous game to be playing, that we're just going to keep doing this disaster proclamation indefinitely for these benefits.
Austin, do you think that the faucet being open creates the dependency, or do you think that the faucet being open so long has just found the cracks of people who need those things?
It's a great question. So the other metric you look at is, what's the unemployment rate? So the Illinois unemployment rate is 4.5%, which is the highest in the country. Of course, it's a chicken and the egg. Is use of these programs so high because our unemployment rate is so high, or is part of the reason for the unemployment rate the fact that we have a lot more folks dependent on these programs than ever before? And of course, people should be, we need a strong social safety net for people who are struggling. But the ultimate goal of those programs has always been and should be, how do you create self-sufficiency and economic independence? So it right now, to me, it seems more like the dependency is having an effect on the unemployment rate rather than the other way around.
Doesn't the unemployment rate reflect people who are out looking for work? People have given up looking for work don't show up in the unemployment rate. So how do these slackers who are living off the government dole show up in unemployment figures?
It's interesting. You have to look at workforce participation rate, and Illinois does have a really tough time on workforce participation rate. I have not looked at what that number looks like this year. But you could also see something like Medicaid dependency and unemployment. If you're able to get those sorts of benefits, it's less likely that you're going to need a job for health insurance benefits, right? Which is a whole screwed up system in the first place. I don't think that should be tied to employment. But that's an example of how the dynamic could work, even though people can write on a form that they're looking for jobs.
Right. And SNAP is not always necessarily tied to employment, because plenty of people have seen their real wages go down, even if their wages have gone up with inflation. Plenty of working people are still on SNAP as they can't meet benefits. But I see the point you're making. I guess my question is there a solution between the federal government and the state governments to wean the faucet down, or is it just an off switch? Like, is there a way for these benefits to gradually go back to normal, or is that the hesitancy then of Governor Pritzker not to simply turn it off?
Could be. But the thing is, it's like waiting doesn't help. It can help. You can say, hey, look, I'm giving out all these benefits now, but eventually you hit a wall. There's a cliff. So
yeah,
the inevitable.
I guess what I'm saying is, if I'm governor and the federal government is offering this money, it is hard to say I'm not going to help my own citizens, especially leading up to an election that we just had, but especially continuing. I mean, I guess as a governor, you say, hey, if this is available, I'm going to do anything I darn well can to help the citizens of my state.
Is the is the governor doing anything that you would say is too heavy-handed, right? Like, businesses are open again. I understand some of the criticism for the way JB handled the pandemic, but it seems to me like most of those things are past now. Is there any evidence that we should not have emergency orders?
I think the answer is, you know, one of the things I know we've talked about in the show, and I know Eric agrees with me on, is at some point you need to have legislative input on some of these major policy decisions. You can't just have the governor deciding where vast sums of money are going in perpetuity forever. So that's, you know, that's one example of, I think. And then the other thing is, we are only one of seven states. I don't know off the top of my head the other seven states, but almost every governor has long since relinquished this authority. So are all of them maybe aren't making the same political calculation as Pritzker, but certainly Democrats and Republican governors have long ago relinquished this.
Well, and also they're safety valves. So if you never close them, if you need to open it again, and it's just been open the whole time, it's not, nothing's going to be there to help. It's like the feds, when they lowered the interest rate so long and they kept them so low, they no longer have that tool in their tool chest to help the economy if the economy had slipped even lower. you've got to, even if it's painful, go back the other direction some point in time to at least reach some sort of equilibrium. I used a lot of big words there to make me sound smarter, by the way. So,
and it worked, by the way. And it worked. It was stunning.
But when you can't have, to my mind, you can't have an emergency that lasts 1,000 days. That's almost a contradiction in terms. If you have a 1,000-day emergency, it's a chronic problem. It's a chronic condition. Emergency powers for a governor, Austin has said this already, but that they should have. When you have something like what happened in March of 2020 crash down on you, you can't wait around for a bunch of legislators to dicker over every last little thing. You got to act. But given some time, that's what the legislature is for. And that's what should have happened. And it's not that onerous in a state like Illinois, where the governor has his political party with super majorities in both chambers of the legislature. So that to ask the legislature to sign off on these things, for them to go through the process, to go through the hearing process, given the amount of time available, that seems more than reasonable to me, to figure out what we want to do as a state and not leave it up to Pritzker. I'd also say that if there's any time for Pritzker not to think like a politician, but to think like someone with long-term plans for the state in mind, now is the time. He was just reelected. And so he's got 3 years at least of slack to do things that might not be all that popular, to cut some of these programs right now in the interest of long-term health of the state, that he's not going to have to face the wrath of the voters.
Especially since he's going to run for president. I mean, he doesn't even have to worry about 3 years. Do you think, Eric, he's going to throw his hat in the ring at some point?
I think he might if Biden decides not to run. He might test the waters in, South Carolina is where he got to go now, the first state?
Allegedly. I think New Hampshire law mandates that they go first, so they still might under penalty of the DCCC, but it's, South Carolina, then Michigan, Nevada together.
Speaking of Joe Biden, would you guys have made the Brittany Griner for Victor Boot deal? Would you have swapped the NBA player for the Merchant of Death, who was in prison for 25 years and had a half a dozen years left on his sentence, which was explained to me as one of the reasons you actually do trade Victor Boot, because you're going to let him out eventually anyway. Get something for him while you can. And maybe the problem was he didn't get enough. But, John, would you have made that deal?
Yeah, I think so. Knowing the basics, right? I think that there's a lot we don't know that goes on behind the scenes about efforts that were made to get Paul Whelan out, maybe others as well. He got an American home. It obviously, as you said, came at a cost, but he was someone that was going to be out of prison anyways. And you fight for the next one after that. You bring people home, especially when, even though she may have broken Russian law, I think it was pretty obvious she was either targeted or at least was a propaganda piece used by Putin to show Americans something. So, yeah, I think you do make that deal. And I would have felt the same way if President Trump made that deal. I think you bring people home.
President Trump didn't make that deal for Whelan when he could have, because he didn't think it was an appropriate trade.
Well, I have a question about whether Griner paid the price of fame when she was taken as a high-value hostage by Russians last February, or whether she reaped the benefits of fame because she moved to the head of the line and was freed in that swap over Whelan or Mark Fogel, who was a teacher over there, who's got a 14-year sentence. American has a 14-year sentence for a strikingly similar crime of trying to bring a little bit of marijuana into the country to treat chronic pain. So why did Brittany Griner move ahead of Mark Fogel in the line? It looks to me like she benefited from the publicity campaign in her behalf. I think that it's a bad idea to trade merchants of death for petty drug offenders, and that it incentivizes, it's really asymmetrical, and incentivizes any hostile foreign country to, in effect, kidnap travelers from the U.S., particularly famous ones, in order to get their people out of jail or prison here. I don't think it was a good trade to trade the merchant of death for Brittany Griner. So I don't think I would have done it. I would have tried to push for a harder bargain. And I say this not knowing what the negotiations were like and not knowing when the Russians were going to walk away from the table and Biden was going to get nothing. So that my gut instinct is that we did not get enough. So I would not have done it as a gut feeling, but again, I don't know exactly what they were faced with. So
I think Eric nailed it in terms of my sentiments. And the biggest thing you worry about is, and maybe this is the case for any prisoner swap period. Like it's just, it will create a moral hazard and an incentive for more capturing of Americans. If you know you can get XYZ for every American you capture, right? And it's always been that way. And this is one of those things where it's like, are you the man in the arena or not? Like, it's very easy to sit here and be like, yeah, you know, it's like baseball trades or something, right? You don't know what all the factors are. It's like, it's very hard to judge. You don't have all the information on the table. But yeah, on its face, it seems to me like this is a, I'm very glad that Brittany Griner is home. And it's, I mean, I don't know, we don't even know the details of her case, but if you were to guess they were completely trumped up charges, I think that's a very fair guess to make. I'm very glad that she's home, but you think that this, if I'm a famous person, I do not go to any country outside the United States that's even close to being an enemy after this.
You know, what bothers me is that of all people, of all times, it's Putin now, you know, the guy who seems to have the least regard for humanity or civilization. And after this deal is made, he was saying things like he was happy with it and he would be open to more such trades, which I don't want to be swapping human beings with Vladimir Putin right now, maybe ever, but especially right now.
John, what's your sense of what WGN listeners feel about this?
John, do you have an answer for that? What do you think our listeners are, where they would?
I don't know. I think it's about, I think it's representative of what we're talking about here, that I think this is one where it's so much gray area, it's almost hard to come down on either side of it.
Oh, well, right. We're not normally complicated by facts when we do this.
I just feel like after Eric and Austin, I agree with a lot of what they said, too. And I think I just wish more people would have said, I'm glad she's home, and preface that before they then went on their other rants about what might have been wrong or imbalanced about it, because a lot of that's true too, right? But I felt like there was a very lack of any sort of celebration, and maybe there shouldn't have been. We're human beings. We're not like wired to like comprehend this much stuff at the same time, and then we just want to spit out a take in 280 characters. And this deserves way much more time and space. But at the end of the day, I think Joe Biden and his team saw a chance to bring someone home, even if it may have been politically advantageous for them and politically advantageous for Vladimir Putin. It's someone coming home to their family. I don't know. Yeah,
sometimes it can be a little bit of both things. I don't know what the percentages are, but I know a lot of our listeners would not have made that deal, in part because Boot has the moniker of merchant of death, right? It's also been suggested to me that having been in jail that long and having aged that much, and he's supposed to be restricted to his country, he's not supposed to travel. I don't know if he's going to do it. I don't know how you sell weapons. But the point is, he's not as dangerous a person as he was, but yes, but like Eric said, we have a petty criminal here for a merchant of death, and that just, it looks so bad. And I think a lot of our listeners key in on that, John. They go, that looks, she doesn't look like a sympathetic character that way to a lot of our listeners. Either they brought it on, she brought it on herself. She was stupid, And it's the merchant of death, for crying out loud. So I think a lot of our listeners are not in favor of this deal.
Right. And there was outrage when Bo Bergdahl was brought home after his imprisonment with the Taliban, after he walked off his military base. And so, you know, there's been some people that suggest that people are upset about this trade because Brittany Griner is gay and black. And I don't think that is the case. I do think it's because people feel like she brought it upon herself and it was a celebrity, because Bo Bergdahl was a white army man, and people were still pissed off about that because of the circumstances. So
like Eric said, she's the beneficiary of and the victim of her celebrity, right? I mean, she was probably snagged because of who she was, and she's also jumped the queue because of who she was. I want to talk a little bit about the World Cup, since, Eric, you brought it up a podcast or two ago. You insisted that it would never, soccer, overtake football as the great passion in America. Are you guys watching the games, even though the matches? Well, you see, I'm learning.
The now, bouts? The,
those things where they run up and down that field?
The chuckers? What do they got?
Well, are you watching it still, even though America's been eliminated, the USA's out? John, have you been watching it much?
I watched the United States tie Iran. That was exciting. No, they beat Iran, excuse me, to make it to the knockout round. And I watched until the Netherlands scored two goals, and I turned it off, and I haven't watched since.
I love the World Cup. It's my favorite sporting event. Besides, if the Cardinals are in playoffs in baseball, I will get more invested in that. That's on the level of a World Cup. I love it. The big problem to me for American adoption of the World Cup is an amazing thing, is that the U.S. color commentators are so bad. Like, we don't have it in our blood to be. We have not. Similar to our stance on, similar to how the U.S. has been progressing on soccer talent, not being like homegrown here, the same thing is true for our Americans who are doing color commentary for soccer. Like,
really?
We don't have the muscle.
I don't know enough to know that they're not good.
It's sad because there's so, what's one of the amazing things about the World Cup, and you see this actually, the Olympics color commentary is great because they get into a lot of the backstory of the individuals and countries that are playing. And a lot of times you'll have experts there on the tactics and all of that. We don't have that as much for soccer. And what's amazing is all these stories about a country like a Morocco or Portugal or an Argentina story this year is incredible. The history of Argentine soccer is amazing. There's a great NPR podcast actually called The Last Cup or La Última Copa about Messi and what he's gone through to bring Argentina to this point. So the storylines are amazing. There's a great book also, because the other big thing, if I try to be a soccer evangelist in the U.S., is like, well, it's really boring. And, you know, they just pass a bunch of times. It's like that Simpsons episode where they have just the ball like going back and forth for soccer. But there's a great book called How to Watch Soccer. It's a graphic illustration book. It's sold by The Athletic, I think, that's online sports journalism thing. That's great and will help you watch soccer and make it more enjoyable for you. I also will shout out, if you want to see Argentina play, I did this 2 weeks ago when Argentina played Australia. Tango Sur and Bodega Sur on Southport are Argentine owned and people watch it there and go absolutely nuts.
Really? NEA
is the other bar on, I think that's on Elston. You can go watch Argentina soccer. It's amazing.
How could you be rooting against Argentina at this point, given Messi's career? I mean, I'm not a soccer fan at all, but I have seen like highlight reels of him on YouTube. The guy is just amazing what he can do. And the fact that he's never won a World Cup makes that a really compelling storyline. And they're going to be, when is the final game? It's Argentina against France.
Sometime. 18th, Sunday, this Sunday at 9 or 10 in the morning.
I might actually watch that. I stopped watching when the U.S. left. I was with John. John and I were ignoring the
John Hansen.
Hansen, yes. We were ignoring the games together after the U.S. was out. But I've been reading the stories about it.
This is from Yahoo. Despite the many off-field issues around the tournament in Qatar, the group stage threw up plenty of thrills and spills, with Argentina losing to Saudi Arabia, going down as one of the greatest shocks of any World Cup in history. Japan also stunned Germany. Spain and England racked up goals in statement opening wins. There have been some interesting on and off the field storylines, but mostly on the field. The play has been just so fun to watch. What was it? Was it the Netherlands match where they were down 2-0 and then they came back and tied it up, and then they had that thing where they do a shootout or whatever? It was so fun. I'll tell you what I like about soccer these days is I just watch it more. The speed and skill of the athletes. Those guys sprint a very long space, stop on a dime, and then do something, zip, 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 and then they take off again. It like NFL-like speeds. It's amazing how great these athletes are. Their bodies are just something to see. The way they hook and curve the ball when they're passing or trying to score, the green pitch and the colorful uniforms. It's really something big. And even though I don't understand it, I go, wow, I'm watching something really big here. They said that the World Cup will have 5 times as many viewers as the Super Bowl. What I don't like are the dramatics when they fall and fake an injury. And what I don't like is how I don't understand the clock. I have no idea when the game's going to be over, and I don't think they do either. And so sometimes when it's an even score or somebody's down a goal, there doesn't seem to be any urgency. I completely don't understand that. It would be like the Bulls down 2 points with 8 seconds left and they're walking it up the court. And you go, no, come on, we're down. Let's go. They have, seem to have no appreciation of time.
So the analogy, John, would be if there's 24 seconds left or whatever in the game, or 10 seconds left in a Bulls game, and the referees just say, well, let's see what the Bulls can do here. And if the Bulls can't score, then the game's over. Because that's kind of what happens with this extra time at the end of the game, at the end of a soccer match. The referees have some sort of vague notion of when it's going to end.
Seriously.
And if there's, I think this is right. Austin can correct me if I'm wrong. And if a team's making a last rush, especially one that's behind, then the referees will say, well, let's see what happens here and see if they, and if they get stopped or if the ball goes out of bounds, then the game's over. But they're not going to just blow the whistle while the guy's winding up to kick the ball. Am
I don't think
right,
that's
Austin?
Officially the rule. I think that's just what they do because it's what, Austin, the refs, the only one that has the ultimate watch. And informally, they will let a play out.
There is a ref who's on the sideline whose responsibility is to hold up what stoppage time should be. And it's called stoppage time because of what you just mentioned, John. If there's an injury on the field, someone has to get carted off or a team's delaying a lot, it's a way to correct for that. So, you know, what's really interesting in this World Cup is there's been longer stoppage time than any soccer competition I've ever watched my entire life, and it's because they're keeping more accurate.
Yeah.
9 or 10 minutes, and then you just get these crazy theatrics, you know, after 10 minutes of overtime basically, where people are scoring like in that Netherlands game. So yeah, I mean, injuries, the injury stuff is tough, and that's a weird cultural thing, I think.
Yeah,
in America too, because none of our other sports you don't have people doing that, so it's, you know, very frustrating. But it's also like, appreciate the theatrics. It's fun. You get this. It's like watching fights in hockey. Like,
watch
this guy fake an injury. It's
fun. Those guys really get injured. That's fun. Watching people fake fall down isn't. Although I talk to a lot of soccer fans who say that it's more embellished in the World Cup than it is perhaps in the Premier League. When they play within their own country, it isn't as much. It does annoy me too, but John, I will agree with you. The biggest thing that I did like, I was just sitting there watching US versus Iran, and I'm like, no other place in the world except the World Cup do you have, I mean, like literal arch political enemies where death could come upon you in different countries playing against each other. That's so cool. The bigness of it is enchanting. And I'm really bummed that when FIFA World Cup comes to the US, Canada, and Mexico in 4 years,
yeah,
Chicago isn't a host city.
Oh,
that
really?
Is, no. And they try to get away from the 94 cities, even though there are some overlaps. Sure, money's involved, but we're supposed to be good at that in Chicago under the table, and we don't have a game here.
Well, that's the other. That was the third thing I was going to mention, John, that bothers me about soccer as I see it on TV, is I think the organizing organization, FIFA or the IOC, are corrupt bodies. And not that the NCAA or the NFL are perfect, but I have so little faith in the integrity of the organizations that put these tournaments on. I don't know if that's well placed, Austin. That's just what it feels like to me.
No, it's extreme. Yeah. It might be the most corrupt institution in the world. It's crazy. It's like worse than the Olympic Committee. It's really terrible. But you know, it's the same thing with the Olympics every 4 years. Insane profligate spending on building all of these stadiums that people have to finance, all the human rights violations as a part of that, all terrible. And yet I'm still, you know, this is the only place where I can watch Messi. So I'm going to watch it. And that's what allows them to be so corrupt.
Well, at the end of the day, it's guys with the ball on the pitch, running up and down, seeing who can score goals, right? So you can see, there is a certain evenness or quality once we just get the guys on the field. And wherever we're playing, we play the damn game.
Austin, do you watch Premier League? Are you always watching?
Sometimes I watch. So I grew up playing soccer. I still play. This year I started playing soccer again in Chicago because I was like, I haven't played soccer for, like, let's do it. So I play pickup soccer in Chicago now too, and I will follow. I think it's a great people have gotten really into English soccer because of that show Welcome to Wrexham with Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where they bought, like, you know, a fourth division or fifth division. It's like a minor leagues English team, and they try to move them up the table, which is also is a great, the promotion and relegation aspect of soccer is fantastic, and no other sport has that. So that's a reason to watch.
What do you mean the promotion and relegation is unique?
If you're a crappy team, you get kicked out of the league, and you have to work your way back up.
Oh, yeah,
so,
right.
It's like that, you know,
in baseball, it would be like if you're the Cubs and you're the worst team in MLB this year, then you're a AAA team and you're playing Iowa, right? That's right.
And so the financial incentive is to not get relegated, is to be good. You can't just be a team that's getting all this money.
Somebody on this panel has not been watching Ted Lasso.
I was just going to say this. Well, I have watched Ted Lasso. Maybe I don't know. Maybe you're referring to me, Eric. But
the relegation, I am, yes. And the relegation is certainly a theme in that show.
Here's just a couple of other stats. The World Cup final will have 5 times the viewership of the Super Bowl. Soccer is now the second most participated sport by Gen Z. Soccer was the 3rd most participated sport by millennials. I presume that means kind of like what you're doing, Austin, but you're participating. Soccer is the fastest growing high school sport in America for both men and women, and has been for the last 10 years. One more. Soccer is future-proofed in the United States, this according to a group advocating for soccer, mind you, as the sport organically grows with immigration. 50 million foreign-born in the U.S. now. Foreign-born U.S. population is predicted to increase by 51% by 2040, which will be at an all-time high. And soccer is the number one sport for 83% of the countries in the world. I threw that out at somebody here in the hall, and they said that doesn't necessarily mean that we're all going to become soccer lovers. It may mean that these foreign-borns will, in fact, be baseball lovers or American football lovers, that they'll migrate to our sport more than we will migrate to theirs. But those are just some interesting statistics about it.
So we're going to have a good team in 2046. Got it.
I am interested to find out what the ratings for this, if Sunday morning, the World Cup final, how that compares to just maybe a basic NFL playoff game, or maybe even just
cartoons
in Chicago, a Bears game. No, I mean, I think that you're talking about, I know it's sad to think about a Bears game, isn't it? How that compares to soccer viewership in the United States. Worldwide, of course. I mean, that statistic is kind of meaningless. The Super Bowl is an American phenomenon. Worldwide, it's the World Cup. But I'll be curious to see what the ratings are for the World Cup final versus even the NFL games that day, or the Monday night or the Sunday night game. So I'll be curious.
You want to put the World Cup final up against an ordinary Sunday night or Monday night NFL game in America for ratings?
I'll get right back to you for just
a second. Austin, should I take that one? Because it seems to me like the World Cup is going to blow a Monday Night Football game out of the water, right?
I think your average Monday Night Football game, definitely in the U.S., I think you should take the bet.
You're saying the average Monday Night Football game in the U.S. will get more viewers than a World Cup final?
Opposite. I think the World Cup final on a Sunday morning, when you have the greatest player ever, arguably, going up against Kylian Mbappe. I don't know how many people love Mbappe in the United States, but he's 23 years old. He has more goals in the World Cup than Messi, and he's incredible. You can't take your eyes off him when you watch him. It should be an amazing thing. Amazing
versus the Bears in Cleveland. Okay. Yeah.
Let's make this specific. I'm talking about Sunday Night Football, which is on NBC, not Monday nights on ESPN. So that's a little bit more diminished. All I'm going to say, let's put our markers down now.
I'm saying
this Sunday night's game, whatever it is, I don't even know what
I don't
it is,
either. I don't care.
Is going to have more viewers than the World Cup final in the United States.
Boy.
I'll take it.
I'll take that too. You're going to, where are you on that, John?
I think I'm with Eric on that one.
Oh, you're just being nice to him.
I'm trying to do 2-2. I'm trying to even it out. It's a tie. We're talking about soccer. Might as well end it a tie.
All right. On that, we'll just end it. But we'll pick it up here on our next podcast. All right, fellas, nice to see you. Nice to hear your voices.
That was fun. I'll see you in a few moments.
John.
Austin Berg, Eric Zorn, John Hansen. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Boy, Eric. That joke, John Hansen, that was a good joke.
That's a good joke, John. Very well done.
That's from my improv days. Got to get the blackout light. There you go.
Eric, you're serious, right? You're not just – you really think that, right, Eric?
I do. I really think that in the U.S., yep.
Okay. So. Talk to you next week.
All right.
See you, buddy.
All right.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.